Chapter 5, Extreme Presentations. Full disclosure before you begin this chapter. In order to cover as many medical complications of eating disorders in this book as possible, in Chapter 5, Part 1, I review the problems that usually only occur in patients with profound underweight from anorexia nervosa. These patients, who often do not think they are sick enough for intensive treatment, deserve to have their stories told too. However, if you are going to read this chapter and decide you aren't sick enough because you don't have one of these extreme and rare medical problems, please skip it. Come back and read it later if you want to, when you're further in your recovery and in a better place. Or omit it permanently. I have no interest in invalidating anyone's struggle. Case, Jessica. Jessica is a 25-year-old cisgender Caucasian female with a history of restrictive anorexia nervosa dating back to when she was 11 years old. It has been a long road. She has experienced countless admissions to inpatient and residential programs, many of which ended when insurance cut out too early. That meant she would have to return home, just weight restored enough to panic, not enough having stayed long to do with the psychological work to tolerate her body's changes. Each time, she would try to work with her home team, motivated by a desire to make progress academically and not fall further behind her classmates. However, the relapses kept occurring. After the age of 18, the struggle became even harder. Jessica regarded herself as an adult and refused treatment for 6 excruciating months. She then went through multiple short admissions that failed to offer her lasting recovery. At age 24, her parents won a lawsuit against their insurance company, and she was able to stay in treatment for 6 months. She emerged fully weight restored and acting like the daughter they remembered, smart, funny, caring, engaged, and thoughtful. Having done a lot of college work online, she enrolled in a community college near home where she lived with her parents and was excited about being a normal student again. Then, 2 months later, Jessica was sexually assaulted at a party. Barely able to speak up about what happened, she was flooded with fears that it was her fault or that her weight-restored body was somehow responsible. Her eating disorder mind was reactivated. Restriction and exercise became her only companions, and she adamantly refused her parents' and team's increasingly desperate pleas to return to treatment. Jessica's weight loss was rapid and extreme, leading her up to present day. After a few months at the lowest body weight she's ever experienced, her eating disorder voice is also the loudest. She has started to vomit almost everything she eats despite never having purged, which scares her. She feels painful fullness after a few bites of food, and sometimes the pain becomes sharp, right in the middle of her stomach. Her eyes have become itchy and light sensitive all the time. At times, she feels like she hears her own voice echoing in her ears and has learned that if she puts her head down on her arms, she gets temporary relief. Food intake is further curtailed by the fact that she feels food gets stuck sometimes as she tries to swallow it. It floods her with panicky feelings as she tries to gulp to get it down. After drinking fluids, she sometimes has to clear her throat or cough. Her voice has become softer, more high-pitched, and nasal-sounding. To her surprise, she develops persistent, mild vaginal bleeding despite not having had a period in 6 years. Feeling too miserable and weak to resist anymore, and finally fearing for her life, she agrees to admit to a medical hospital that specializes in eating disorders. Background. Patients should start their care in an expert hospital setting when they have become sufficiently medically compromised. Having helped run the top such medical program for adults in the country for many years, I have seen this firsthand. Even a terrific, academically renowned university hospital with eating disorder expertise almost invariably fails adults with severe anorexia nervosa. They are just not equipped with the multidisciplinary team needed to help a sensitive, mentally ill, starving patient navigate everything at once. The moment-to-moment panic and desire to leave, the optimization of all the physical impediments to taking in food, the prevention of injury or harm, the art of refeeding, and the delicate support of someone to do the two things they abhor the most, rest and nourish. Children and adolescents, by contrast, often do receive good initial and medical care at standard top hospitals. Perhaps because pediatricians receive training in childhood malnutrition, or because parents can mandate treatment. For the care of medically compromised adults with eating disorders, all members of the hospital staff should possess true expertise in this patient population. Nurses, nursing assistants, doctors, dietitians, psychologists, physical therapists, occupational therapists, social workers, intake professionals, and support staff. It is worth pushing to admit or transfer to an expert program when the patient is severely medically compromised because the state-of-the-art, evidence-based care is provided across the board. Centers with expertise have cared for a high enough volume of patients that they have made countless improvements in how care is provided. A patient deemed a medical mystery can often be handled smoothly and productively in a place that cares for similarly ill patients all the time. While every case of anorexia nervosa is severe, in that it carries the highest mortality rate of any mental health diagnosis, for simplicity's sake, I will use the term severe anorexia nervosa to describe the patients in this chapter. Dysphagia. Dysphagia, pronounced dysphagia, is the term that is used to describe difficulty swallowing oral contents into the stomach, and it can be deadly. Oropharyngeal dysphagia specifically refers to dysfunction of the upper part of the swallow, but since that's a mouthful itself, I will just use the term dysphagia. In severe anorexia nervosa, all of the body's muscles have shrunk and become weak. This includes the swallowing muscles, which now cannot coordinate properly to move a bolus of food or fluid from the mouth to the stomach. Gastroesophageal reflux disease, or GERD, can also cause or to contribute to dysphagia. Either as part of the denial of disease severity or because dysfunction worsens slowly over time, patients may not mention or even recognize that they have dysphagia. Asking a number of questions can help. Are you finding that foods, especially dry foods or pills, are getting stuck in your throat? Do you have to swallow a number of times to get them down? Are you coughing after drinking liquids? Has your cough become weaker? Have you had pneumonia recently? A yes to any of these questions in an individual with severe anorexia nervosa should trigger an urgent speech language pathologist, SLP, evaluation. Up to a fifth of patients admitted to a specialty eating disorder program had dysphagia symptoms, and half of those were found on evaluation to have significant swallowing problems. Dysphagia increases the risk of aspiration pneumonia, where oral contents end up in the lungs instead of the stomach and set up a lung infection. A bite of food, a sip of liquid, or even a swallow of bacteria-rich saliva can all lead to aspiration pneumonia. Aspiration pneumonia is one of the ways that patients with anorexia nervosa can die because even with the great antibiotics and life support, their weakened bodies and immune systems may not be able to pull through. A capable SLP in the right hospital setting can diagnose dysphagia at the bedside, obtain further data with a video swallow test, and can recommend altered food and liquid textures without compressing caloric intake. SLPs also oversee specific exercises to strengthen the swallowing muscles, and superb nursing can help diminish aspiration risk at meals and overnight. In rare cases, someone who cannot yet swallow safely can have a thin feeding tube passed through their nose into their stomach. After a period of nutritional rehabilitation and exercises, the body heals and the patient can swallow again. Other less medically compromised patients with eating disorders may also have the sensation of swallowing difficulty. Referring these patients to an SLP for testing is appropriate. Some learn that psychological distress manifests physically in swallowing difficulty. The muscles are strong, but their function is impeded through a mechanism that the patient cannot consciously control. There is no less scary and intrusive for the patient, but the fix is primarily a psychological one rather than a medical one. Excellent psychotherapy can help patients identify emotional distress and work on a relaxation technique that will help them regain full function. Autophonia and lagophthalmos. Two medical problems frequently show up alongside dysphagia in severe anorexia nervosa. Autophonia and lagophthalmos. Autophonia, also called patulous eustachian tubes, refers to the sensation of hearing one's own voice echoing in one's head or having muffled hearing. The eustachian tube is the inner ear equalizer that opens when one yawns or swallows as the pressure changes in an elevator or airplane. When a person loses so much weight that the eustachian tube stays open all of the time, their hearing and voice quality change. Many patients learn on their own because their symptom is so uncomfortable that if they put their heads down on their arms in front of them, the whooshing goes away. That's because gravity can temporarily close the eustachian tubes. While not dangerous, it is nonetheless a physical sign to pay attention to and use to motivate patients. You have lost so much weight that you no longer even have the tiny flat fat pad that your inner ear needs. Rehydration when needed and weight restoration resolve autophonia. The other finding that often goes along with autophonia and dysphagia is lagophthalmos. Normally, a fat pad behind our eyeballs keeps the orbit in position so that our eyelids glide over the eye and touch during a blink or at night during sleep. Each time we blink, we draw a layer of moisture over our eyeballs and prevent the corneas from drying out. Patients with severe anorexia nervosa can lose the fat pad behind the eyeballs. The eyes sink back into the person's head such that the eyelids don't fully close or blink at night. This is called lagophthalmos. It's diagnosed by asking the person to close their eyes softly, not squeezing the lids closed, and observing that you can still see the white of the eye. When the corneas are constantly exposed to air, they can become very dry, causing itchy red eyes that are photophobic or sensitive to light. The biggest risk of lagophthalmos is corneal scarring from chronic dryness. To prevent permanent complications, patients should use preservative-free eye drops throughout the day and unmedicated lubricant ointment in the eyes at night to moisten the eyes and improve symptoms. Weight restoration restores the proper lid dynamics. Pancreatitis. Another potentially life-threatening medical complication in severe anorexia nervosa relates to the sudden onset of abdominal pain and vomiting after meals, even when a patient has never deliberately purged in their life. The three likeliest causes are severe gastroparesis, as I discussed in Chapter 2, pancreatitis, an inflammation of the pancreas, and superior mesenteric artery, or SMA syndrome. Virtually all patients with severe anorexia nervosa have gastroparesis. However, in someone that is malnourished with these symptoms, I would always evaluate for pancreatitis and SMA syndrome before proceeding with nutritional rehabilitation. The pancreas is an organ that performs many vital functions in the body. It produces insulin and glucagon, which it releases directly into the bloodstream. In addition, it releases digestive enzymes into the small intestine through a tube called the pancreatic duct. These enzymes digest fats, carbohydrates, and proteins as they emerge from the stomach. When this process goes awry, pancreatic enzymes can back up and begin to digest the pancreas itself, causing a great deal of pain and inflammation. This is called pancreatitis. There are many causes of pancreatitis. Overall, the commonest causes are alcohol abuse and gallstones. In patients with eating disorders, severe malnutrition and nutritional rehabilitation can both cause it. In particular, the use of total parenteral nutrition, TPN, or feeding through a deep vein. A simple blood lipase level is sufficient to diagnose pancreatitis. It must be managed in a hospital as patients cannot eat with this illness, lest they trigger a fresh wave of pancreatic enzyme production. Pancreatitis requires careful electrolyte monitoring, intravenous fluids, and pain medications. Superior mesenteric artery, or SMA syndrome. The other etiology of abdominal pain and vomiting in anorexia nervosa that must be evaluated urgently is SMA syndrome. The aorta is the largest artery in our body, and it runs right down the middle of our torso after emerging from the heart, a big highway from which other arteries branch off. The superior mesenteric artery is one such branch, and it supplies blood to the intestines and pancreas. The SMA emerges from the aorta at an angle of about 45 degrees. Normal body fat between the two arteries maintains that angle. The small intestine, specifically the third portion of the duodenum, passes between these two structures like a soft tube passing between the dull blades of an open pair of scissors. In severe malnutrition, which in the case refers to very low body weight or very rapid weight loss, the fat pad shrinks substantially. As a result, the SMA aortic angle shrinks to around 10 to 25 degrees, closing the two arteries like the blades of the pair of scissors coming together. The duodenum gets mechanically pinched between these two arteries. Now, compressed from the mechanically pin oh, sorry, compressed from the outside, it cannot let digesting food through normally. That food backs up into the stomach, and pain and vomiting ensue. Liquids are often still able to pass through unless the obstruction has become complete. SMA syndrome can be diagnosed either by a CAT scan, which evaluates the SMA aortic angle, or by a barium study with a small bowel follow-through. In the latter study, the patient drinks some barium, and a camera tracks the progress of the barium through the stomach and then into the small intestine. The video will show if the thick fluid gets backed up at the third portion of the duodenum. Most cases of SMA syndrome reflect partial obstruction, not complete. Most cases of SMA syndrome reflect partial obstruction, not complete. The question of partial or complete obstruction is a vital question to answer on radiographic studies, as it makes all the difference in how one proceeds with nutritional rehabilitation. Treatment of SMA syndrome. Treatment of SMA syndrome hinges upon nutritional rehabilitation to the point where the fat pad reaccumulates, causing the angle between the two arteries to increase, opening the scissors. However, it can be a challenge to accomplish weight gain when the patient has a partial obstruction of the intestine with pain and vomiting. The best and safest way to feed patients is to start with oral liquid supplements alone, without sacrificing calories. Liquids typically can still pass through an impinged intestine. Gastroparesis should still be aggressively treated with metoclopramide as well, unless the duodenal obstruction is complete. It is vital to remove every possible physiologic barrier for the suffering patient. Unfortunately, consuming only high-density liquid supplements, ice cream, and full-fat yogurt for up to 2 weeks can trigger eating disordered thoughts and make already anxious patients even more uncomfortable in the hospital. However, it's far safer and more effective than any other treatment options. Surgical jejunal feeding tubes, also called surgical J-tubes, placed through the abdominal wall into the small intestine beyond the blockage make great sense, theoretically, for SMA syndrome. They provide nourishment beyond the obstruction while the patient takes nothing by mouth. Unfortunately, J-tubes turn out to be painful and complicated in those with severe anorexia nervosa. Other surgical management, such as rerouting of the intestines around the blockage, should be avoided at all costs. Despite a study showing positive results, patients should be given the opportunity to restore weight fully before considering surgery. Full weight restoration prior to surgery consideration is imperative, as individuals' lives have been ruined by these surgeries. The site where intestines were sewed to intestine can become scarred and obstructed itself, leading to further operations. Rarely, a patient may present with complete obstruction from SMA syndrome. In this case, when gastroparesis is also too severe to tolerate sufficient oral caloric liquids, intravenous feeding, or TPN, can be used for a week or two for initial weight gain, and then the patient can switch to oral liquids. Acute gastric dilation, or dilatation. A rare but critical medical complication of both severe gastroparesis and SMA syndrome is called acute gastric dilatation. The stomach organ expands excessively, as stomach contents have built up over time without being released into the small intestine, With such stretching, the risk is rupture. Untreated gastroparesis, as well as severe SMA syndrome, can cause this. Patients with bulimia nervosa and binge eating disorder, or BED, can also develop gastric dilatation from the amount of binged foods. The overstretched stomach can get so full that efforts to purge by vomiting are unsuccessful. Acute abdominal pain should immediately trigger a plain X-ray of the abdomen because acute gastric dilatation can be diagnosed swiftly. Treatment involves decompressing the stomach through a large tube that passes through the nose into the stomach while anticipating and managing gastric bleeding. Immediate surgical consultation should be requested in an effort to avoid gastric rupture. Prevention is key. Early use of metoclopramide on admission to prevent complications of gastroparesis, early diagnosis of SMA syndrome, and the use of only liquid calories all help. Abnormal vaginal bleeding. As I discussed in Chapter 3, patients with anorexia nervosa can continue to have regular menstrual periods or regain their periods at very low body weights. As you know, severe malnutrition typically causes reversion of sex hormones to pre-pubertal levels, and in females, the uterus and ovaries shrink. Without estrogen, the uterine lining thins, a state called atrophic endometrium. This thinning can lead to bleeding at times. If a patient uses tampons for this spotting or bleeding, the tampons can actually form an ulcer in the vaginal wall. Essentially, the amount of bleeding is too low for tampon use, plus the vaginal wall is fragile from lack of estrogen. The ulcer itself can continue to bleed, leading to persistent tampon use and exacerbating the whole problem. Diagnosis is made by pelvic exam, looking for vaginal ulceration. Treatment, fortunately, is pretty easy. The ulcer will heal when the patients discontinue tampon use. An applicator of estrogen cream in the vagina for a week or so can also help with the vaginal tissue. I have seen patients prescribed systemic hormones, such as birth control pills, in an effort to control persistent spotting while underweight. Awareness of their unique physiology would have spared the use of systemic hormones, which don't help, and allowed swift diagnosis and treatment. Physical weakness and fall risk. Patients with severe anorexia nervosa may lack insight into how physically weak they have become. In hospital settings, falls can lead to broken bones, bleeding, or other injuries. It would be easy to assume that a hospital patient in her 20s who has been overexercising and is eager to walk laps around the unit would be at a low fall risk. However, up to 16% of patients with severe anorexia nervosa may be at moderate or high fall risk on admission. Many of my patients have described enforced bed rest in other eating disorder programs where they were instructed to consume calories and hold still all day. This potentially increases the risk of skin pressure sores in addition to being intolerable emotionally. Good physical and occupational therapy is a vital and often neglected aspect of care for this group of patients. Case resolution, Jessica. Jessica is admitted to a hospital that specializes in severe eating disorders. She has a one-on-one nurse's aide around the clock in her room to keep her physically safe, help her, and support her through meals. When she remembers the many hospitals she's been in that just sent food trays up and how she pushed the meal around but ate very little the whole time, she remembered how important the one-on-one aid is. She sees a dietitian every weekday for meal planning and meets with a psychologist one-on-one most days of the week for support through this immensely difficult time. The doctors know right away how to diagnose and ameliorate her medical problems. While her lipase comes back negative for pancreatitis, she does have some SMA syndrome, which she reluctantly agrees to a temporary liquid meal plan. Jessica engages with a physical and occupational therapist a few times a week. She is amazed by how weak she had become in her last few weeks at home. They work together until she's safe in the shower, can perform activities of daily living without assistance, and can walk smoothly again. Special cushions are put in her chair so that the sore skin over her sit bones doesn't turn into pressure ulcers. With cessation of tampon use, her vaginal bleeding stops. Feeling her body becoming stronger and more independent motivates her, and taking in sufficient calories improves her mood and sleep. Her nurses help highlight all the positive biofeedback her body is giving her about getting nourished. Her glucose stabilizes, her heart rates become less extreme, and her blood pressure improves. About 3 weeks, she is able to start eating solid foods again. In her first week of hospitalization, despite starting at 1,600 calories a day, her metabolism speeds up so quickly that she gains no weight. By the time she's ready to discharge to an inpatient eating disorder program a few weeks later, she's gained, unbeknownst to her, around 3 pounds a week after the first week, which is right on target for this setting. She has no edema or water weight, is having regular bowel movements, is eating 3,200 calories a day of balanced meals and snacks, has normal laboratory values and much improved vital signs, and remembers again what her values are and why she wants recovery. The days aren't easy, but she uses near-death experience to remind herself that she never wants to be in that situation again. Jessica is ready to work on the psychological side of her eating disorder from day one in her next program because the medical issues have been fully addressed. The parables of the fortress and the nuclear wasteland and the perfectionist and the appreciative achiever. These are two parables I have shared with countless patients over the years. When hope feels dim, the recovery process feels too hard, or when the eating disorder voice is so loud and mean, the patients wonder if they have the strength to keep fighting. I often turn one or both of these stories. I often tell the first story when my patient sits in a crisis of anxiety about the idea of full weight restoration, or when the idea of recovery seems overwhelming. In this story, the castle represents recovery and the wasteland represents the eating disorder. I am standing on the wall of a castle, the parapet in front of me. I'm looking out over a nuclear wasteland, dusty, dark, and grim. Behind me, within the castle walls, lies a beautiful garden. The trees are richly green and heavy with fruit. Fragrant and colorful flowers grow abundantly. The light is golden and the pathway winds through the garden. My patient is scrabbling around on the ground in the nuclear wasteland. I stand on the castle wall and I call to her, come into this castle and walk with me to the garden. She says desperately, I'm scared. I keep talking, inviting her to keep getting closer to the castle. I say, come stand next to me. See what the castle is like compared to your wasteland. Feel the sunlight on your face in the garden, and then you can make a decision about where you want to be. Many of my patients crawl all the way up to the castle gates, only to cower back into the dust, saying they're just too frightened to come through. I remind them that life isn't perfect within the castle walls, but it's a lot better than being out in the wasteland. The next parable is my version of a story of a dear friend of mine tells, and he heard the original one from his Harvard professors, Tal Ben-Shahar, who went on to write books about bringing happiness to life. I tell this story when my patient feels resistant to the idea of resting, recharging, or going a little easier on themselves. They worry that if they are kinder to themselves, they won't achieve as much or live up to their own expectations. Two hikers, the perfectionist and the appreciative achiever, set off to climb a mountain. The perfectionist arrives at the summit and is full of dissatisfaction. He says, I didn't like the climb. The mountain wasn't fast enough. I didn't train hard enough. I didn't take the optimal route, and my equipment didn't work as well as it should have. The appreciative achiever arrives at the very same summit, takes a deep breath, and looks around in wonder. He says, what a beautiful view. What a joy to have used my own strength to accomplish this. How lucky I am to be standing at the top of this mountain. Both hikers submitted. They both achieved the same very accomplishment. The perfectionist couldn't celebrate and could only have criticism for himself and the experience, while the appreciative achiever was able to live in the moment and reflect joyfully on what he had done. Our souls will bend and ultimately break under constant self-criticism. Constant self-judgment is a toxic environment to live in. We have to remember to celebrate all of our victories, large and small. This doesn't mean we have become complacent or stop working to improve. It means that our souls need to receive acknowledgement when we've done something that we worked hard for. That accomplishment doesn't have to be big or important, it just needs to be recognized. Otherwise, when we give ourselves the consistent message of, "You're inadequate and disappointing," we will despair and run out of energy. Physical illness, chronic pain, or exacerbation of mental illness will stop us in our tracks and force us to disengage from life because the soul can't thrive under such circumstances. Be an appreciative achiever, not a perfectionist.